Mr. Adams in reel four. Can you describe the site and the various locations on the site of the units?
The sites themselves are basically open spaces, either a field, sometimes on the outskirts of an industrial establishment similar to the steelworks or something like that. The site itself with the projector, that's the site itself, often consisted of a hut or huts, which consisted of the living quarters, possibly a dining room, an office, and the senior NCOs billets themselves, because they are slept separate from the other ranks. Some 300 to 400 yards away was possibly another small area which the generator was located, which supplied the electricity for the searchlight itself.
Well, why was that so far away from the searchlight?
I think it was more of a safety reason, so that if they ever decided in the event of an air raid to come down and, as you'll appreciate, a searchlight was obviously a target. If they decided to come down either to bomb it or to machine gun it, which was often the case, at least the only thing that went was possibly the searchlight projector and the generator, which was probably a lot harder to replace, was some 300 or 400 yards away. So the two were separated for military reasons.
And did the generator operator, was his accommodation at the generator?
No. He was located, generally speaking, with the rest of the crew, the searchlight crew. But on spring into action, he had to sprint that little bit further to his generator and start the generator up, which was more often than not was by hand, incidentally. There were some occasions where, in fact, the generator was housed in a lorry, and the lorry engine was started, and a gear labourer was engaged, which eventually started the generator up. So the one was sort of compatible with the other. But generally speaking, the generators were of a Lister type generator. And these were hand cranked until the diesel engine started, and then the electricity on, there was a rheostat on an instrument board, and the rheostat was turned up to the desired level of output. So the two were kept separate, although for living conditions and every other aspect, they were all on the same site.
How did that first winter of 39-40, which was a rather severe winter, how did that affect your efficiency?
Personally, it affected me quite badly, because I was on a site which was actually isolated. We were off the main road, and at that particular time I was somewhere at the foot of the Cleveland Hills against what they call the big bridge on the Cleveland Hills. We can see it from here, actually.
Isn't the Cook Monument, is that?
No. The name will come before long. Anyway, we were some 6 or 7 fields away from the main road. In fact, we were actually isolated, and there was anything up to 2 to 3 foot of snow in the fields leading from the main road. It was just up the road from the outskirts of Middlesbrough. No. But anyway, quite often that first winter, it was a severe winter, and it did affect me personally for that reason alone. I don't think I've endured anything so bad winter-wise since, actually.
Were you in tents at that time? Or had you moved?
Yes. We were in the old-fashioned bell tent with, I think there was either 8 or 10 of us in the one tent, where you slept with your head to the outside of the tent and your feet to the centre again, the pole. And needless to say, although we had amp and blankets, more often than not, most of us also covered our bed with our greatcoats to keep us warm. When you were on duty, which was quite often in those days, because with a small detachment on a searchlight site, the numbers weren't really in excess. By the time you took away such things as an NCO and possibly a clerk and a cook, who incidentally didn't obviously participate in the roster, the duty rosters, the rest of the guard's duties, and bearing in mind that there was a guard on the main site and there was also a guard on the generator, so there were two guards at the time, and quite often your duties, your guard duties, could be a case of two on and four off, which didn't allow you for much sleep in the middle of the night or any time after, say, 10 or 12 o'clock. You might get probably 4 hours sleep, you might get 6 hours sleep, but you very rarely got much more than that.
And in a sense, during that time, of course, and during the night, did you have to sleep ready for racing out to the searchlight? Did you have your uniform still on, or part of it still on?
More often than not, most of us had we went to bed partly dressed, so that if there was an emergency, it didn't take you more than a minute or two to be dressed and out on your post.
The feeding, where was your food coming from?
Well, more often than not, there was within the hutting arrangements on the site, there was a small hut which was designated as the dining room. And most of us, except the senior NCO, used to eat in that particular hut. It doubled up as a recreation hut, where when you were off duty, if you wanted to play cards or dominoes or darts, something like that. And in those days, we relied a lot on these charitable organisations for such things as dominoes, darts, cards, and even radios in those days were supplied by, little portable radios were supplied by, I think it was a firm called the Nuffield Organisation in those days. Small portable radios.
Rations would presumably come up from headquarters or the supply areas at the back.
A ration wagon used to arrive on the site almost every day, and the cook and the cook's orderly, the cook's assistant, whatever you like to call them, were responsible for taking the amount of rations, and of course the rations depended, as always, on the number of the men on the site. So the rations were supplied and then offloaded and then utilised during the course of the following week by the cook and his cook's assistant.
If you weren't called out during that night for any raids or possible raids, any warnings, what time would the normal reveille be?
I think around about 7 o'clock in the morning.
And what were the first things that you all did then, of course, didn't you?
Well, the first thing was used to get up and get washed, shaved, dressed, and ready for breakfast.
And then
after that, say around about 8:30, there'll probably be a roll call, and each and every one of us had our own respective duties. The searchlight operator was responsible for the projector. The other operators were responsible for other parts of the searchlight projector itself. The operator that looked after the Lister generator, he was responsible for cleaning it down, making sure that the oil was up to a respectable level, and that the diesel oil in the tank was adequate for a full night's running. So we all have our own duties. And then on top of that, there was also assistance in cleaning the hut, laying your kit out, and in general keeping the whole place tidy.
What was your particular task?
Cleaning the projector, making sure the inside of the projector was clean. And quite often we used to take the back off and clean it with a mixture of paraffin and white chalk, and used to put a nice thin film on the back of it and then leave it to dry and then take it off and polish it. And also to make sure that the inside of the searchlights themselves were carboned up, the carbon being the two sticks, the carbon sticks that actually ignited and give you the light inside the projector. But it also used to, from time to time, little small particles of the carbon used to break off and just drop in the bottom of the housing, the projector housing. You had to make sure that was clean, and also that the front glass on the projector was clean, and the inside of the front. They were both removable, both the back of the projector and the front of the projector, so you could clean the inside and outside of the glass on the floor, as it were, and you could clean the mirror on the back on the floor, and that would give you access into the centre of the projector to clean all the dust and small particles of the carbon that was broken off.
Did you have any PE or PT exercises to keep yourselves fit?
From time to time, the senior NCO would dedicate half an hour to general PE, running around the site, general gymnastics, which you get on PE classes. But we were never idle for very long.
Did you have a break in the middle of the morning?
Yes, more often around about 10 o'clock, they'd probably knock off for a cup of tea. And then coffee wasn't so much of the thing of the day then, it was mostly tea.
And the rest of the morning you went ahead with these duties you've been
describing? With the rest of the duties until it came to lunchtime. Probably round about sometime after lunch, then things would sort of ease off and you would be allowed to participate in any recreational duties such as reading, listening to the radio, game of darts, a game of cards, something like that. So there was a certain amount of free time. But then, of course, during the winter of that year, bearing in mind that the war started in the September and we were already heading towards the dark days of the winter, your duties, your standby duties, you were always on call virtually. And your guard duties used to proceed during the day just as well. There was always somebody on guard at either the generator or on the main site itself.
So if a warning came, stand to warning came, what kind of speed or kind of time did it take you to get out into your positions?
I think more often than not they were looking for somewhere within about 2 to 3 minutes to be out on your post and ready. Whether that was we also had a small gun on the site, and in the early days that gun was an old fashioned Lewis gun with a magazine on the top. That was one of the duties during the course of the day, that was the Lewis gun was stripped down, cleaned, oiled and replaced again, and made sure that any magazines that were by the side of the gun or in the box against the gun were also fully charged up, so that they could be used as one magazine emptied, another one was automatically replaced. But these were an old-fashioned gun which I believe had been used in the First World War on aircraft.
Were they sandbagged in the various positions?
Oh yes. Yes, yes. The searchlights themselves weren't sandbagged in, because the operating arm, as I said, was probably 18 to 20 foot long away from the actual projector. So a sandbagged area around that way would have given you some limitations on your operation. But the lowest gun emplacement was more often than not sandbagged, and there was quite often protective barricades around the generator up to a level of probably 3 or 4 foot or something like that, just to protect it if there was any shrapnel blast or anything like that.
In the early days when you were in tents, where were your latrines?
You had to dig them. They were very, very primitive. You used to dig a hole and put an ordinary chemical toilet seat, and everything that was done went into the hole. And when that was filled, or started to smell a little bit too much, it was actually filled in and another one dug. So they were very, very primitive.
Did you have access to a canteen?
No. No. The one thing that used to come round in those days, well, there were two things actually, but they were of the same sort of supply, and that was a YMCA van used to come round on the site with such things as chocolate bars, if any of the lads wanted anything like hair cream or anything of that nature, toiletries, you were able to buy them. And the other van that used to come round on the site quite regularly was the Red Shield, which was the Salvation Army. And I think most people quite often look forward to either one of those two vans coming on the site.
Mail, was that regular?
The
mail you got, your letters and... Did you get that regular? Was it regularly received?
Obviously that quite often didn't go to the site itself. It went to HQ, and of course the mail was sorted out at HQ and then delivered with the ration wagon to the site itself, and then the clerk on the site would then distribute the letters to. But being so close to home, quite often we didn't think about letters, because it was quite often easy to get home when you were allowed your free time.
And what free time were you allowed? What kind of leave did you get?
Actual leave, you weren't allowed any. It was only later on when they started to say, well, they say 10, 12, maybe 14 men on a site. Two of you can have the day off. And once again, you took it in rotations, and two people could be allowed to come home. And a lot of us that were stationed pretty close to Hartlepool were able to get home, round the likes of Gisborough, Loftus and places like that. But once we moved further away, when we moved to round the Scarborough area, that leave was conditional to what they call 48-hour passes, and you had to get home, get back within 48 hours. So it didn't allow you a lot of options to get home. But whilst we were in the Gisborough area, we were able to get home periodically.
Where did you spend your time when you did get a short spell away? Other than going home, I mean.
Well, at one period we were stationed down the Whitby area, and we used to go down to Whitby itself. Used to go into the cinema, sometimes into the pub for a drink, and sometimes we used to go into the likes of YMCA and places like that, Tock H in Whitby itself. But you always found somewhere to go on the time when you knew you couldn't get home.
Did you get involved with the local farmers and assisting them in their work?
Oh yes, in some cases the connection with the local farmers was on a friendly basis. Sometimes it developed into a bit of a frictional sort of atmosphere. One in particular was just outside of Redcar, and the farmer in that particular case had a young collie dog, and we had a stray dog which was only a puppy, which had attached itself to our site. And one particular instance, this little stray pup of ours managed to make friends with a collie dog pup from the farmer, and the two of them were running about together. And apparently, according to the farmer, they'd been chasing the sheep. And in this particular instance, he took a shotgun and took a pot shot at the two dogs, although the one dog that was hit was ours, not his own. So there was a certain amount of animosity developed between the farmer and the people on the site because of it. But generally speaking, the farming community and the local community and people on the sites got on very, very well together.
Were you invited into the homes of the local people?
Yes, in some of the cases, you'll appreciate that because of the smallness of the site, in a lot of cases, sites didn't have bathing facilities. There was sufficient ablution facilities for washing and shaving, but when it came to bathing, that was out of the question as the sites were so small. And quite often, arrangements were made with local people with either large houses or something of that nature for the local troops to visit those houses and enjoy the bathing facilities. I can quote two particular cases in this, and one was at Gromont in North Yorkshire, where one of the local people, a rather wealthy man in those days, allowed people to use his home and the bath on a rota basis, and were always made very welcome there. And another case was just outside of Whitby, and the Pyman family from Hartlepool had a big hall opposite there's a castle just outside of Whitby, and I can't for the life of me think of the name of it, but this pieman's house was a large house, actually. I think they called it Dunsley Hall. Now, within Dunsley Hall, the bathing arrangements were more than adequate for the people that were occupying the house. So we were allowed to use their bathing arrangements on a rotation basis. So you could go down there, and we were always made welcome after having had a bath. Probably finish up having tea and cakes, sandwiches and things like that, which were a luxury to us in those days.
There were no baths at headquarters at all?
There were baths in the main headquarters. The likes of Huttongate Camp, they were adequate because they were purpose-built camps with bathing arrangements in the clusters of huts. They were built in what the term in those days, the huts were known as spiders because of the arrangement of the corridors and things. And then once again, when we moved to headquarters, which was at Scullby Hall, just outside of Scarborough, that once again was an adequately sized building which had a lot of bathing arrangements. So, yes, the headquarters had baths, the sites didn't have baths.
Got any memories of any particular enemy planes coming over and working on them?
I think the one thing I do remember when we were stationed on the outskirts of Redcar, just not far from what is now the RCI Wilton site, we used to periodically have the local coastal command planes going over on a regular basis. It was almost like a bus service going up and down the course, and they used to patrol the course from a given area to, say, Flamborough Head or something like that. And their patrols were quite regular, and we used to watch them going over in the daylight and watch them coming back, or hear them coming back in the dark. You could always tell a British plane from a foreign plane.
Yes, I was going to ask you how you identified an enemy plane from a friendly plane, particularly at night if you had the search.
In those days, long before the radar became a very popular thing, it was sound. The British planes had a almost, what shall I call it, a single sound drone to it, where the German planes had more or less like an oscillating drone to it, and you could tell and say that's a Jerry or that's a British plane.
And you've no memories of any particular night or incident when you were actually in action in all senses of the word?
Well, periodically, you used to have exercises, and these were to keep everybody on the toes. This applied to the operators on the anti-aircraft gun sites and the operators on the searchlight sites, and they used to have exercises on, and the exercise would be given from a given period. And one particular time at the site I was on in Redcar, the exercise period was coming to an end, and we were on the verge of shutting down, or standing down, as I called it in those days. We were on the verge of standing down, and in fact, at that particular time, there were also British aircraft coming back from a raid over Germany, and they came in almost on the fringe of the exercise being ended. But unfortunately, at the same time, there were German planes that followed the British planes in, and of course they were coming in, and you were suddenly set with two sets of planes coming in, one British and one German. It was a case of detecting which was which. And unfortunately, there was a plane, now I'm not sure whether it was a Canadian plane, but in fact it was eventually picked out with a searchlight, and it was shot down in mistake for being a German plane. And unfortunately, the remains of that fell in a field just again what is now the Lackenby Steelworks, around that way, off Dormanstown and around that way. And of course, you can imagine the feeling amongst both searchlight crews and gun crews that in fact one of ours had been shot down. And the main reason, I believe, was that the plane had been badly hit on its raid over Germany, and a lot of its communications with ground had been destroyed, so it was virtually coming in blind and had no way of identifying itself from the plane that was following it.